Welcome. Welcome to everyone listening all around the world, all across the United States. We are coming to you live from the real journalism headquarters, which tonight is the Coast to Coast AM studios right here in Los Angeles, California. Standing in this weekend, I'm your host, Jimmy Church. How you doing? Tonight, my guest is Barrett Brown. Over the years, I have covered journalism. I've covered free speech, hacktivism, anonymous, censorship, the internet, the dark web. I've covered it here on Coast, Fade to Black, and my series Breaking Mysterious on the History Channel. And I have never held back. On all three shows, I have interviewed both Greg Hausch and Gabriella Coleman about anonymous and journalism and hacktivism. But there's always been the missing piece, Barrett Brown. Tonight's broadcast took almost 2 years to happen. Now, let me explain. You see, Barrett can write. He's one of the best, talented. And he can speak well, too, by the way. And his screen time in the documentaries We Are Legion, Terms and Conditions May Apply, and The Hacker Wars are riveting, some of the best. And I read and watched everything Barrett. And as a journalist, he turned his attention towards the analysis of hacked emails and other leaked information concerning the inner workings of the cyber military industrial complex. And in his ties to Anonymous, with that and everything else, you have the perfect mix for getting attention by the man. And he did. The FBI raided his home and his mother's house, and this was based on information supplied by an informant who flipped the now infamous Sabu. More on that later on tonight. Then on September 12, 2012, Brown was arrested with a total media lockdown ordered by the judge, and he was threatened with 105 years in prison. The gag order wasn't lifted until April 23, 2014. During his incarceration, Brown wrote a series of columns for D Magazine titled The Barrett Brown Review of Arts and Letters in Jail. And in 2015, he transitioned from D over to The Intercept, and in 2016, The Intercept won a National Magazine Award for three of Barrett's columns. Barrett was then released from prison on November 29th, 2016. Why was he sent to federal prison? Get this. He was sent to prison for cutting and pasting a link. A hyperlink. Upon his release, I immediately reached out to him through Greg Hausch, but there was too much pressure from the government not to speak to the media at that time. I tried. And then on April 27th, just a few months later, 2017, Brown was arrested again and held on unknown charges for 4 days. And when this was going down, I reported on this, and we were trying to figure out what was going on. There was no information. He was just grabbed. Very strange to have a journalist just taken off the streets. This is America, right? We have freedom of the press, certain protections of free speech, or so we think. Well, then he was released and warned once again not to speak to the media. And I thought at that time that I would never get a chance for the interview. But last month, Barrett and I finally talked. And when he told me that he's been listening to Coast since back in the day, well, seriously, I knew I had my in. And I'd get that opportunity if the man would finally let it happen. And we're going to ignore that for now. Because tonight, Barrett Brown is on Coast to Coast AM. And there's nothing stopping us. You know, we're going to find out what it's like to take on the military-industrial complex, intelligence and surveillance operations, world governments, censorship, and the mass media. And all along, ultimately paying a price for it with a copy and paste of a link. Oh, yeah. And let's not forget, this is Coast. So Barrett will reveal what he knows about the UFO situation. That's going to surprise you. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. Tonight is going to be a very special evening for myself and for all of you. Barrett Brown is here. Turn down the lights. The studio here is always dark. You can follow me right now on Twitter at JChurchRadio. I say it every night I'm on the air. You know the drill. Twitter is always live to my left. Any questions or comments for myself or Barrett, post them there. And if it's good, I'll read it on the air. Enjoy the bumper music tonight, by the way. Carefully selected for Barrett. So check all of that out. And again, post your comments right there on Twitter. And it's also Sunday night. And Barrett said to me, I want to take some phone calls. I said, Barrett, it's all yours. This is you tonight. It's Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. And I'll be right back with my guest, Barrett Brown. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. It's been a great Saturday. And tonight's going to be a great Sunday here on Coast to Coast. I want to thank everybody for hanging out with me this weekend. You can follow me on Twitter at JChurchRadio. You can also follow Barrett at BarrettBrown_. And it's right there. It's up in Twitter. So go and follow. And you can hit Barrett up too and follow what he is doing. He is a writer. He's an anarchist activist. His work has appeared in Vanity Fair, The Guardian, The Intercept, Huffington Post, New York Press, The Skeptic, The Daily Beast, Al Jazeera, and dozens of other outlets. And in 2009, he founded Project PM, a distributed think tank, which was later repurposed to oversee a crowdsourced investigation into the private espionage industry and the intelligence community at large via emails stolen from federal contractors and other sources. In 2011 and 2012, he worked with Anonymous on campaigns involving the Tunisian Revolution, government misconduct, and other issues. And in 2012, he was arrested and later sentenced to 4 years in federal prison on charges stemming from his investigations and work with Anonymous. While imprisoned, he won the National Magazine Award for his column, The Barrett Brown Review of Arts and Letters from Prison. And upon his release in late 2016, he began work on the Pursuance System, a platform for mass civic engagement and coordinated opposition. And his third book, My Glorious Defeats, will be released in 2019. I would like to welcome for the first time to Coast AM, Mr. Barrett Brown. Barrett, good evening. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's always nice to get a 5-minute introduction.
Yeah, right. Well, you've earned it. So let's just start there. Barrett, were you like this in the third grade? Were you like getting your friends together? You know what, man? We're being oppressed in the cafeteria. I can get us double ups on pizza on Friday, man. We need to band together. You know, did you always have this in your DNA?
Actually, it's funny you should mention the third grade and pizza. I was not yet organizing, I would say, effective groups at that point. We did have a public school gang of sorts that we called D-Force, and we had no objective and no enemies, really, unfortunately. We tried to generate enemies. We tried to get other people to start other gangs. It just didn't work out. I did get suspended in third grade, in-school suspension for ordering a pizza from the school payphone for lunch, but I had permission from my mother, I had money for it, but that was against the rules. So I did come into conflict, yes, very early on, with whatever the powers would be. And I think that's good. I think that helps to, train one for when things get a little bit more serious.
It's interesting that I feel like I was right. You know, sometimes you are who you are, right?
Absolutely.
Now let's go forward. Now that I knocked that one out of the park, I find that very interesting.
It's all downhill from here.
Yeah, it is. Right, right. Is the time spent in prison, and now that you're out and you can go and reflect like everybody should when they are released from prison, would you have done anything different?
Not vis-a-vis me and the things that happened to me. There were things I look back and regret, just in terms of nothing really did harm to anybody, but just if I look back, there's a lot of transcripts. There's a lot of artifacts from that period in which I can see myself talking to others. You know, there's long, long transcripts of me and the other anonymous guys chatting in these chat rooms. And sometimes I look back at me like chortling over our enemies. You know, our enemies were valid enemies. They were bad people. But I don't like looking back and seeing the immaturity that we engaged in, perhaps as a coping mechanism. Beyond that, no, everything worked out well. I mean, everything worked out in such a way that the case I was trying to make about what ails this country and what threats we're going to start having to deal with increasingly in the future, I think that case was made for me by the way that things played out, by the overblown prosecution, by some of the things that happened in that, you know, that case. For me, things worked out.
You were, and still are, you know, but especially back then, an in-demand journalist. You had no issues with your career, which means you're bright and you're intelligent, and you should be able to think for yourself and think in 3D and see through things. Did you see any of this coming? You know, like I said in my intro, you made yourself very visible, right? I mean, you really did. Did you see this coming, and did it all ultimately just catch you by surprise?
Yes. So in February, within 2 months after I really got involved with Anonymous, I was invited in by Greg Hausch to come work on the Synesia Project.
Right.
Because I had written about Anonymous a year prior, sort of predicting that they would come into real conflict with nation states, and that this would be indicative of a future trend in which these emergent groups of individuals around the world taking advantage of the fact that you can now collaborate on this large scale would become a threat to nation states. And so shortly after, you know, within pretty early on, when we came into conflict all of a sudden with the U.S. government and with some of its partners and sort of its private partners, it became clear that we had stepped on some toes, that, you know, by stepping on these toes, there was no going back. And so we were prepared. I mean, we knew we were under surveillance from about the point after we exposed a program that the DOJ had been involved in. And in fact, specifically when a congressman in Georgia called for congressional investigation into the things we'd exposed, and it was shot down by another congressman, I realized then that despite the things we'd revealed, despite the indefensible nature of the programs and operations we had thwarted effectively, we were not going to come out of this ourselves safely. We were now under threat. And so I had about a year after that to get used to the idea that I would be in prison at some point.
So you actually resigned that thought?
Well, I mean, it from day to day, there was always different. You know, at some points there was the idea that maybe if we keep going, maybe if we expose more and we do a better job of articulating why this is important, perhaps we'll get the backing, the support from major reporters, major press outlets that would make it difficult for the DOJ to retaliate against us. And so we had sort of a two birds and one stone situation, whereby we wanted to bring more attention to these things. We wanted to take the stuff that we had revealed and make sure they were properly understood by a large swath of the public and by the press. And at the same time, that was also to our advantage to do that, because to that extent, whatever they came after us with, the DOJ and the FBI in this country, and then agencies in England and elsewhere, we had anonymous participants, it would all be very clear that it was retaliation. And eventually it did become clear in my case, in other cases. So it worked out. But we knew that we were sort of, that we had to establish a paper trail that would be sufficient so that when we were facing decades in prison in some cases, such as my case,
right,
that we would be able to say, look, this is why. And that even if I did end up doing several decades in prison, which it did look like for a while that I might do, it would have not been for nothing.
The point where Anonymous went from hacking video games and delivering pizzas and causing fax machines to run out of toner, right, and lulls, to affecting world governments and states around this planet, that's a big step. At one point, did any of you just go, how did we get here? You know, are we in over our heads at this point?
There was definitely a lot of that, those discussions, particularly, you know, early 2011 when things started happening very quickly. There was, you know, yeah, absolutely. And that transition from a group that goes and commits these surreal Dadaist pranks on online games and whatnot, and then suddenly we're having the head of the NSA give a speech about how we are a threat and will within 2 years be able to seize control of power plants in the U.S. That's not just important for this story or for Anonymous or any of that stuff. It's important. It's an important lesson about what kind of age we live in, where that sort of thing is not only possible,
it's real,
but can happen by accident.
Right, right. And there's another important point here, and I want to hit this before we get to the break, but which is this: as you guys are putting all of this stuff together, the threat is more because Anonymous was decentralized. The man didn't have a way to chase any of this down. And a lot of this that came down on out of you guys was probably from anger and frustration from not knowing what to do ultimately with this new technology.
Certainly, this was a very new thing. I mean, it did have parallels with previous situations, including things like the mafia, including things like civil rights activists in the 60s, anti-war activists in the 60s. There were some models and frameworks that could apply to parts of this, and they did. So, I mean, some of the things that they eventually reacted with were old procedures, just in a new guise. But having said that, yes, this was a fundamentally new kind of thing. It was something that evolved very, very quickly in ways that we could not anticipate. And it was hard to cut off the head of it. There were things they could do to perhaps hasten its deterioration. And there was always, of course, the strategy of finding the best hackers, arresting them, finding people like me. I mean, I never had to be found. I was always in the open. But striking down those of us who were involved in other aspects of things and sending a message. So we know a little bit more now than we did back then about the extent of their response to us. We know from the Snowden documents, for instance, that GCHQ, the British sort of equivalent to the CIA or NSA,
right,
NSA really, had a strategy in place to go after anonymous activists, in England and the U.S. And some of the things they did, ranging from like mundane things to attacking someone's cell phone, which happened to me, and I didn't know where it was coming from, to disinformation, those were indeed, done. And when this came out, of course, the GCHQ said this is all legal and we've never done anything illegal. And that's quite possible. There was a huge range of responses from different agencies at different times. There was a huge range of responses from some of these private entities that were sort of allied with the government on this. And we did what we could to sort of respond to those, to assess them, and most importantly, to report them, to make sure they were known.
Now, we've got 45 seconds. I'll get the question out quick. You were really playing with the big boys. We're talking about the intelligence community, defense contractors, the DOJ, the Pentagon, the military industrial complex. The real spooks are looking at you. Did you see anything? Was there surveillance from across the street? Were you being tailed?
There was a couple of incidents that happened towards the end in terms of physical presence. I mean, everything else prior to that was mostly, that they could easily access us online, of course, in addition to the secret search warrants they had where they were reading my emails, from early on. But, yeah, there was one occasion where a bar I frequent in Dallas, which was referenced in a D Magazine article that came out about me, a big profile. There was a guy there one night who...
Well, I've got to take a break. We're going to finish this. I got to take a hard network break here, Barrett. We're going to finish that when we come back. This is Coast to Coast AM. This is a special event on Sunday. Barrett Brown. We'll be right back. Stay with us. All right, welcome back. Nothing like a little Led Zeppelin on a Sunday night. Our guest is Barrett Brown. And Barrett, I wanted to jump in really quick and allow you to finish the guy in the Dallas bar. What was that?
There's a bar called the Quarter Bar that was about a block away from where I lived at the time in uptown Dallas. And it was well known that I went there. It would have been mentioned a couple times in a big profile article that D Magazine wrote about me in the middle of 2011. And so one evening I showed up, and there was a guy in there that I spotted immediately. He was a very tall fellow. He was clearly ex-military. He was not someone who would normally be in that bar.
Right.
And there was a bartender there that I knew he seemed distressed. And I walked over and kind of assessed the situation. It became clear that this guy was there to check things out, and I left about 30 seconds later. That was the only time until before my raid, before my second raid, the fourth time I was actually arrested, when I saw people that were clearly from the feds for me. And the second case, the afternoon before they arrested me with the SWAT team, there were two clearly ex-military guys hanging around in the courtyard of my apartment complex, looking at my balcony. Presumably they were there to just make sure that the layout of the apartment complex was, you know, a certain way, just to check things out before the raid. And I saw them, and it just became clear to me these guys were, you know, with the FBI or something. It's not something I'm generally paranoid about. I've never, aside from those occasions until very recently, I'll tell you about this in a second, you know, saw someone and said, oh, that guy must be here from the government for me. But it was just so obvious. I started recording them with my laptop. I brought my laptop out, had a camera on it, the balcony, and they did not react as civilians would to having some strange guy suddenly record them from his balcony. They looked at me, milled around for a second, and then left.
You know what's funny? In hindsight, right, you should have taken him a bag of donuts and some coffee.
Well, I didn't have any donuts, and the coffee's for me. You know, it's not for the cops.
Yeah, there you go.
They can get their own coffee.
Barrett, I gotta take one more quick break right here. We'll pick up when we come back. This is a special event here on Coast to Coast AM. It's Barrett Brown. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. You can follow me on Twitter at JChurchRadio. You can follow Barrett at BarrettBrown_ on Twitter. We have everything up there, and you can go and follow Barrett right now. So Barrett, the statement that I made opening up the show about ultimately what you went to prison for was copying and pasting a link. And although that sounds a bit strange to most, because everybody copies and pastes a link every single day, is that statement that I made accurate?
Well, it's the most accurate statement you can make, I think. It's such a complicated case.
Right.
It can be boiled down in certain ways, and that was the way it was generally presented. So that did turn out to be eventually what the centerpiece of my charges were. But another way to put it, is that the investigation into me began. We didn't know this at the time, but we suspected it. But the secret search warrants that they had filed against me starting about a month after my role became clear in helping to expose and document the DOJ and other agencies' links to this criminal conspiracy, Team Themis, that hit the news for a while after Anonymous exposed it. They were looking at me because of that, because of this H.P. Gary thing, this whole other incident that occurred 8 months before Stratford, 9 months before Stratford. Indeed, what is public that people can see is there was a search warrant executed against me 6 months before I was eventually arrested. That Michael Hastings, the late Michael Hastings, posted on BuzzFeed at the time,
right,
and which lists all these other firms: H.P. Gary, in-game systems, the website echelon2.org, which is no longer exists, but on which we compile our information, and my group Project PM, which was this crowdsourced investigation into these matters, into these intelligence contractors, the DOJ's involvement with them, FBI, et cetera. That was by their own admission what this was about. Stratford had happened when the search warrant was executed 4 months prior. It was not listed in the search warrant. So the Stratford thing and the linking, the copy paste of the link, that was what they ultimately settled on as here's a viable charge that we can do without perhaps getting into the subject of these other earlier firms he investigated that we just don't want to talk about and that those firms don't want to talk about. I was facing the bulk of the prison time I was facing for copying and pasting that link. And indeed, I was facing 22 years mandatory minimum for copying and pasting that link.
And this is the other part that I would like to get some clarity on. I look at this, and so do others. I want to hear your opinion, the facts of the case, that ultimately you were set up. This was a sting operation, and the hack that happened with Jeremy Hammond was allowed to happen by the FBI so they could catch him and everybody else that Sabu was ratting out. Now, am I characterizing this in the correct way?
We know for a certainty that the FBI knew about this, hack, from the point that Sabu became involved in it, because he was, of course, there. He had been turned secretly about 6 months prior to this or 5 months prior to this. So we know that. We also know from court documents in Jeremy Hammond's case in particular that Stratford, the company that was hacked, was told by the FBI, just go about your business as usual. Do not inform your customers. Don't do anything to your servers. Let this happen. We know that for sure. What we don't know is some of the, like how much of this, of what played out, how much of that was planned and how much was them reacting to possibilities and the potential as they came about. So in a situation like this, it is very difficult for the FBI or anyone to keep that degree of control over a situation. What they really do instead is perhaps nudge things in certain ways, but they really just wait for opportunities. So in my case, the Stratford hack, it may have been in part allowed to proceed with a view to getting me.
Right.
But it was definitely, I would say almost definitely, also intended to get Jeremy Hammond, who was one of the major hackers we had, aside from Sabu, and Jeremy Hammond was the only one, but the most major one at this point, who was still in play, still in operation, had not yet went dark, as some of the other hackers had.
Right.
Was still very actively going after targets and was dangerous and was working with me sometimes on some of these campaigns. And then beyond that, the other facet of this that may have been something they came up with was to have Sabu, after these emails were stolen from Stratford, these 6 million emails, have him offer WikiLeaks those emails in exchange for payment. And that's the offer that Sabu made under the aegis of the FBI to Julian Assange. And Julian Assange did not accept that. He wasn't going to pay for those materials. He may have been suspicious. I don't know what his thinking was on that. But the emails did eventually go to WikiLeaks. Anyway, you know, gratis, mm-hmm. Which was the right move. But so just in general, this is one of those things where there was a lot of details that were kind of assumed early on. And there's a lot of things we've learned since then, and we're never going to have the totality of those answers. We can just sort of come to approximations of what was the goal here, how did it change, how much of this was just them waiting for us to slip up, et cetera. Now, in my case, they could not have anticipated or put it about such that Jeremy Hammond would take credit card numbers from Stratford's customers, use them to donate to charities, and put them in a anonymous chat room where I would accidentally copy and paste them, thinking they were emails. When it happened, I don't think I have reason to believe, based on documents I've seen, that came out in Jeremy Hammond's case regarding a confidential informant, that someone mentioned to them, oh yeah, they expected emails that Brown was looking for, the link he pasted the other day, was actually the credit card numbers. It doesn't look like that's something they realized that they would use as a charge against me until later on, just the way that played out.
Right.
It was something that they later said, well, we couldn't really find anything after this year and a half of investigating that we could really charge him with and not embarrass certain other portions of the government, so let's do this. You know, and it wasn't enough, of course. They eventually had to drop all these charges. So,
do you know how insane and intense this story is? I mean, just to listen to it, it's insane on every level. But I have to ask the obvious. Looking back, Barrett, I know at the time nothing, you weren't tipped off about Sabu, but today, looking back, was there one thing that you just missed that you realize now that you just you missed it?
I don't think there was a particular thing. The main problem here was that there was a great deal. I mean, we were all amateurs, and some of us were perhaps more astute than others at dealing with these issues of intelligence infiltration, et cetera. And there was a lot of loose talk about who was secretly CIA. So the fact that, for instance, there were always stray people saying, oh, Barrett Brown's probably CIA, he's leading us into some trap probably, you know, that makes you more skeptical about when you hear about other people being described as such. Now, in retrospect, I do know now about conversations with people around this whereby they deemed Sabu to be a snitch. At the same time, Sabu was calling his other guys a snitch. And so obviously when people are crying wolf like that, it does make it harder to determine who's who. Now, I was suspicious of Sabu, but not in that respect. A lot of the stuff he was doing, along with other people who were not FBI, was counterproductive throughout that time. And so that was the problem, is that you couldn't really differentiate reliably between stupid stuff that these young people, and me in many cases, were doing that was counterproductive, and, you know, actual intervention by a government entity that wanted this stuff to be disrupted.
You were just a journalist, man.
Well, that's how I started.
Right. You know what I mean? You were just a journalist, and to get involved with all of this, you know, Sabu and intelligence agencies and
right.
and Straff and Gary, all of the that's a complex, crazy, serious situation you found yourself in.
There was constant intrigue. There was intrigue among us. There was outsiders that we could not identify. There was just a constant just back and forth and just maelstrom of confusion and intrigue. And I mean, there's so much that happened that, you know, I'm doing this book that I've finished, and I'm not even able to cover a great deal of just very interesting stuff, very, very relevant stuff, because there was just so much of it.
Now,
we came into a situation in which suddenly we were having to make what would be the equivalent of high-level intelligence decisions, as if we were, you know, two-star generals.
Right. That's one of the most interesting parts of all of this. When I say in over your head, that's an understatement.
Right.
But now, okay, so you get arrested. They right before that, they raided your residence. They raided your mom's place and threatened her. We don't need to spend time on that. But what is important here for the audience to understand, when you were arrested in 2012 in September, you did not, that was it. You were locked up until you were released in 2016.
That's another interesting part of this, is that, yes, I went to a bond hearing the day after I was arrested. And an FBI agent, Alan Lynn, took the stand. And, of course, when you're arrested like that, and you suddenly have a court-appointed lawyer who is not familiar with this case and suddenly has to be the one to argue in front of a judge with two FBI agents and a prosecutor who have been waiting for this for almost 2 years.
Right.
You're at a disadvantage. You're even at a more disadvantage because the FBI can essentially lie at will in many districts. It's not the same across the country. There are some districts, federal districts, that are different than others in terms of the judicial culture, how judges view the FBI. But this one happened to be one of the worst ones, North Texas. We had judges that did not pick up on things that they should have been suspicious of. So the FBI agent in this case told the judge that I had, and there's a transcript of this, so, you know, and I think it's unsealed. I'm actually talking about it in the book, so I guess we can discuss it. He claimed I had traveled to Tunisia recently. Now, I've never been to Tunisia. We did work on a assistance program to the Tunisian Democratic Revolutionaries, but I've never been anywhere near Tunisia. He claimed that I've been involved in these swatting attacks where people call, they spoof a 911 call to try to get the police to respond to someone else's house.
Right.
And then never brought these things up again because they just weren't true. And it was okay for them, from their standpoint, to bring it up in front of a magistrate judge, knowing that there's not a lot of, you know, it's not an organized system where the judge is like, oh, by the way, that thing you accused him of that's really serious, what was that? Do you have evidence? That doesn't happen. People lose, these judges lose track of these things.
Plus, so, it's a very quick hearing, too, the bond hearing. It's just like bam, 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 bam.
It was about 45 minutes.
Right.
And they're talking about Stratford, they're talking about H.B. Gary. There's a point at which my lawyer comes up and starts asking, you know, cross-examining the FBI agent and saying, okay, so you're talking about the Stratford hack. And the judge interrupts him. And this is Judge Stickney in Dallas. And he says, well, we've already, you know, this case involves something more recent stuff, and I'm sure you'll find it in the indictment. I mean, insane. They just spent 20 minutes, this FBI agent, this prosecutor, talking about Stratford, talking about H.B. Gary, talking about the background, making allegations against me that were demonstrably untrue in terms of how that went down. And then my court-appointed lawyer just tries to ask questions about it, and the judge shoots him down. That was one of several things that I think people will be surprised by. I was certainly surprised by it. I was perhaps hard to astonish by that point, but the things that I saw, just the inefficiencies and just the foolishness of federal judges, who I'm sure are not dumb people, but perhaps just don't have a good grasp of, you know, this system. I was constantly astonished by the things that were allowed to happen.
Well, plus, these are very serious, you know, statements. We're talking about, you know, world governments and Tunisia and security and the Pentagon and hacking. And, I mean, this is very heavy stuff. So then immediately, the judge slams a gag order on everything. And you, being a journalist and somebody that has been very vocal that could speak out about the facts of this case, you could not. You couldn't speak to anybody about it.
There was a few month period after the arrest in which I could speak frankly to reporters on the phone. And that was, the prosecution came in and shut that down. They filed a motion saying that Barrett Brown has been talking to reporters and he's not telling the truth, which, of course, is something to be decided in a trial. And it was, of course, was not true. And he's also written this article for The Guardian from jail, which I did. I wrote an article after the Snowden revelations basically saying, first of all, I told you so. Second of all, here are some specific companies, including Booz Allen Hamilton. You guys, people should be looking into that we looked into. There's information that we, at great risk and great personal sacrifice, brought out. Please incorporate this into the public conversation. So this, the prosecutor was in front of the judge, and this was reported on. There were journalists here, and said, quote, he was critical of the government, unquote, in this Guardian article, and that this was a reason why I should be slapped with a gag order.
And that gag order wasn't lifted for 2 years.
Yeah, it wasn't until after I was sentenced, yes.
That's absolutely insane. Now, we're going to have to take a break here. And when we come back, I would like to talk about a little bit about your time in prison. We've got a lot of things to discuss tonight. But give me the 10-second answer here. Was prison okay for you, or was it a rough road?
It was a form of experience. I didn't do college, really. I quit college about a month. So this was my 4 years of education.
You know, so many people, Barrett, go through their lives without that experience, and you certainly got yours. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. Tonight, it's Barrett Brown. We'll be right back. Stay with us.